Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Rob,
I'm back.
Dude, Game of Thrones is back.
I'm back. Game of Thrones is back.
Have you been watching it?
I have been. I've been pretty excited. This, I mean, it's not Sunday yet. Episode 3 has not happened, but it will have by the time this is out.
And I don't want to give anything away, but things are building up. So no, we're not going to give any spoilers here, but I'm just saying things are building up that you know shit's going to go down. And everybody's got these, you have these Deadpools, like who's going to survive the, you know, who's going to sit on the throne.
Yeah, you wouldn't even do it. You had answer 40 questions.
Can I still do it?
No.
Well, no one's died.
Doesn't matter. Because you know part of the questions are what episode did they die?
Oh, yeah.
So you're eliminating two of six.
But you know what? I think Sansa, Jon Snow, and Arya might be the final three.
All right, so who do you think is going to sit on the throne at the end?
I'm going to have to go with, I mean...
Podrick?
No, Daenerys is going to try and kill Jon Snow, and then Arya is going to kill her. It's going to be this weird bloodbath. And I have a picture, I have a feeling of Sansa crawling up to the throne, bloody and just like... Hmm. And crawling up, and she's the last one there. Anyway, it's going to be exciting. I can't wait till the final final episodes. But our guest today.
You didn't ask me what I
think. Oh, yeah. Who do you think is going to be on the throne?
Well, it's tough because I don't think it's going to be a happy ending.
Tyrion's dying.
He's dying. I don't think the Starks as a whole, like, they're not all going to live and then have the throne. I think Daenerys getting the throne is...
Yeah. Anyway, today we've got a great guest, David Nutter. He directs...
He directs three of the last six Game of Thrones.
Three of the last six, one, two, and four. He directed the Red Wedding. You're going to get a lot of insight. Whether you're a filmmaker or not, you're going to get a lot of insight. This guy has directed over 20 pilots have gone to series.
Some of those snuck by. I don't know, like...
Smallville. Arrow, Supernatural. This guy is a legend. David Nutter. Anybody and everybody in the industry knows him. If you don't know him and you're out there in the Midwest where I grew up, just listen because you're going to find it interesting. He's a really interesting guy and such a likable guy. Let's get inside David Nutter.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
This is a real treat for me. Thank you for allowing me to be inside of you, David Nutter.
Come right inside. There's plenty of room.
Alan Miles, who created Smallville, they're excited. They said, when are you going to have us on? You have him on before us. But I said, hey, he's done a lot more work than you guys.
Exactly.
No, that's not true. They're great guys, and
yes,
I love them.
Are.
They're going to come on. How do we meet? You remember how we met?
You have to remind me. Hit me.
First of all, I'm sitting with a huge, huge director. He's done so much. You know, I was looking at your resume. I didn't know this shit. I mean, I know you're not somebody who loves to talk about themselves like me, but Jack and Bobby, Without a Trace, Smallville, Dark Angel, Roswell, Sleepwalkers, Millennium, Above and Beyond, Eastwick, Mentalist, Terminator, Traveler, Supernatural, The Doctor, Arrow, The Advocates, The Flash, Deception. These aren't just episodes of television. You directed the pilots for these shows, correct?
Yes, I've sold about 20 shows.
You sold 20 shows, and at one point you had 16 in a row that you sold, that when you shot the pilot, it went to series?
Yes.
Do you ever look in the mirror and say, yeah, you're fucking the shit, man?
No. It's all about just finding the right material and finding something I can fall in love with.
Do you fall in love easily?
No.
You've been with the same woman since, what,
84?
84.
30 plus years.
It's crazy to me how, like, someone that has a body of work like this, where they come from. Like, were you, like, you hear about Spielberg and you hear about these big directors and they studied at USC and they always wanted to be a filmmaker. And was that you?
I wanted to be the next Barry Manilow. How's that sound?
Do you know? Are you kidding me? Are you playing with me right now?
I'm not kidding.
Because you know I'm a huge Barry Manilow fan.
Well, there you go.
If I can, you name five Barry Manilow songs.
Mandy.
Copacabana.
Could It Be Magic?
Yeah. A Weekend in New England.
Sang that one in high school with the old story.
Back in New England.
Yeah.
So you wanted to be the next Barry Manilow.
I did want to be the next Barry Manilow. It's funny. I wanted to see him at the Hollywood Bowl a few years ago, and I called the ticket scalper. I said, I want the best seat to Barry Manilow. And the guy says, don't worry, there'll be no problem getting
him. Were you front row practically?
It was fantastic. It was excellent.
And he sang everything, right?
Oh, he sang it all. It was beautiful.
He's got so much energy.
He's fantastic.
Did he sing Even Now?
Oh, yeah.
When I have... And so you're a singer.
Well, I started off with one, yeah.
Do you still sing? Does your wife catch you singing and go, God, you're an, you have a voice
not,
of an
not,
angel.
Not anymore. Not anymore. I've kind of fallen out of it and all that stuff. People don't want to...
They don't want to hear it?
No.
Do you find yourself singing on sets, on pilots?
Well, it's crazy. I just was at a concert at the Hollywood Bowl. I had Michael McDonald.
I was there.
Kenny Loggins.
I was there.
And Christopher Cross.
I brought 50 of my friends for my birthday.
Of course, of course. I knew every song.
Wasn't it amazing?
It was fantastic. It was a great concert.
I keep forget not in love anymore.
Oh, yeah, fantastic.
See, I love it because you're around my age.
Exactly.
Right?
And I'm older, much older.
You're much older?
Yeah.
How old are you?
58.
Are you 58?
Yeah.
You have such a soft, sweet face. Soft, sweet, young face, David. You do. You look. Doesn't he look young? He doesn't look 58. He just nods.
I only feel 58.
You feel 58?
Yeah. No, what it was, it was the fact that in high school, I sang, and it was musicals, the whole thing, acted, and the whole deal. I loved doing that so much. I went to college. I was a voice major. And then when I got into college, in first year of college, and I realized that I'm not going to do what I want, be what I want to be. I'm not that good. Then I started writing music. I started maybe the business of music and did that. None of that really was something that turned me on. And in 1980, I took a filmmaking class because I was going to maybe write music for movies.
Right.
And the roll-up-your-sleeve process of making movies, and I wrote music for this little movie I did. I said, maybe I can touch an audience through that.
Through music, through score.
Through score.
Like next John Williams.
Well, exactly, or Thomas Newman or something. But then I decided... Through directing, if I just wrote my thesis, it was more of a blue-collar profession in some respects at that point. It was just hard, that hard work. And I was at a film school in which they had a lot of equipment, but not a lot of students.
Where was this?
University of Miami, Florida.
Hard to get into?
No, not at all.
It wasn't?
It wasn't much of a film school at all.
Try really. Getting into Western Kentucky University.
Exactly.
Easy.
Exactly.
Pretty easy.
Yeah.
Good school.
But yeah, they kept saying suntan you for me, but I was always too busy making films and so forth. It was the kind of thing in which I just loved making films, and I just started getting into that, and I started doing films that way.
Well, how did you know you were good? I mean, first of all, were you popular in high school?
Well, you know, I was popular in the theater department and that kind of stuff, and music.
So people were like, this guy is a talent. He could sing. Could you dance?
In ninth grade, I just moved to Clearwater, Florida, and I just moved there from a little small town called Venice, Florida, and I had a high tenor voice. And I had done all state choir and all that kind of stuff as a young junior high school kid, singing churches and so forth. And they were doing the high school, in high school, they were doing the musical Music Man. So the music teacher and his wife was, you know, the voice teacher. She said, well, you should be Marcel Washburn. You know, the Shapoopy Shapoopy kid. So, and I was seeing all the young, you know, high school students, the seniors or juniors and all that kind of stuff, checking out these other people who they were thinking about, the people they were thinking about to play Harold Hill. And I went, okay, yeah. So I did all my rehearsals for Marcel Schwarzman and so forth. But on the weekends, I rehearsed Harold Hill and got it down. The whole moves, all the moves, the dance moves, wow. The whole thing, learned it and everything. And I tried out for that role. And everyone was like, holy shit. Because they had to give me something because I got it perfectly pretty much compared to everybody else. And from that moment on, I realized that if you work hard enough, and really focus, dreams can come true. And I just basically at that point, you know, have always taken that adage and really worked very hard to get the stuff I want.
I think that's true. I think that a lot of times people, they're missing an element. Like you can want to be something all you want, but if you don't go out and just get it and focus and really... Because you could be distracted easily. You could, a lot of people don't have the talent, but if they work hard at something, you think dreams can be met.
I didn't really have all the talent myself. I mean, I learned how to direct in directing, you know, in the sense that I directed a series, The Adventures of Superboy, for 20 episodes right out of the film school and after I directed the Silver feature.
Why would they give you that? I mean, right out of school, how good were you that you took a directing class and you were that good?
Here's what kind of happened. It was at an early spring, I'll say. In my last year of film school, what really kind of happened was I was in the music program. And in the 3 years in the music program, I decided to take some film classes. So I told my mom, oh, I'm getting a communications degree. But all I was taking was film classes. I wasn't thinking anything else required.
Really?
So I said to myself, well, this something better happen here. So there was another fellow student, George Fernandez, who was a Vietnam veteran.
Right.
And George had written a play called Vietnam Trilogy. And he wanted basically to videotape this play he did and try to sell it to Showtime. And I was kind of the most successful director there in the school. And he said, why don't you direct it? And it was about three acts of, he was a Vietnam veteran. So the first act was about a group of veterans in the 60s in country, 70s. And the second act was a group of veterans in a pool hall, angry and bitter. And the third act was a husband and wife talking to a psychiatrist about post-traumatic stress disorder. And in 1983, who knew about PTSD?
Nobody talked about that.
So I said, George, why don't we take this third act and make a movie out of it and turn that into something and utilize sequences from the 60s and 70s and do flashbacks and things like that. He said, okay, let's do it. We came out to Los Angeles. I was kind of reminding myself coming up to your place tonight, driving along Mulholland Drive, and we rented a room at the Chateau Marmont. We were auditioning actors and the whole thing. But there was one actor I wanted to hire that I'd only seen him in one movie. And I'd heard that he was not working a lot. He had five failed pilots in NBC. He just got out of AA and just got into AA and was someone that no one really thought much of. But I had this feeling.
Who was it?
His name was Don Johnson. So he came to Miami. We hired him for the movie. In 1984, January of 84, in the shooting of that movie, at the end of the shooting of the movie, I went to his trailer one day and I saw he had a script in his trailer in his room called Miami Vice. And I told him that Anthony Yerkovich was a writer and Michael Mann was a producer. And Don didn't know who Michael Mann really was. So I said, Don, all I can tell you, Jericho Miles, blah, 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 the thief, Michael Mann's a tremendous talent. You got to really take this seriously. This is a tremendous project, I bet. The producers came down, they met Don on our set, we talked to them and so forth, saw that Don was just straight and narrow, working hard. He became Sonny Crockett.
Do you still talk to him?
No, not really. We haven't lost touch, I guess.
Did he ever call you and say, Dave, you were right? God, well, thank God you walked into my trailer.
No, I doubt that.
No?
No, but so then I moved out, we waited about a year before we got a distributor. And back in those days, independent films were like, there's us and Heartland, maybe just a few other things. It was really rare to get.
And you were only 19?
I was 23.
Hmm.
And getting a distributor and so forth was difficult. So we finally got a distributor. I moved to Los Angeles in 1986, thinking that, oh, this is going to really happen for me now. Because we had great reviews and great responses and so forth. And it was the thing in which, one thing about the movie that was very successful was the fact that we were playing at vet centers. And veterans were seeing it. For the first time, veterans were watching this movie. And they were, like, in tears.
How powerful is that?
It was really quite something. It was the kind of thing in which David Sheehan was a film critic for KNBC out here. And he basically, I heard David Sheehan's going to review your picture tonight. So I'm all excited. I sit down and watch the TV at 11 o'clock, 11:15, he comes on. And he says, well, you know, I wouldn't have gone and seen it. It was a Thursday night. He does a review. I wouldn't have gone and seen this movie except for Don Johnson, of course, was on Sonny Crockett on Miami Vice on Friday nights. Blah, 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 blah. But all I can tell you is one thing. Ceasefire is a major achievement in modern-day screen dramas. I was like,
wow. Heart just stopped.
It just stopped. And I said, well, this is going to be something that's going to happen for me, I guess. I got an agent. I started to take meetings and so forth and so on and so forth. But the problem was I wasn't a writer. I didn't have that next project. Didn't have that, like, what's that?
What's next?
What do I want to do next? What do I do next? And I'd say, I don't know, but I'm ready.
Right.
So I should have kind of gotten into television because that's kind of where that kind of thing was happening. I should have gone into. But I didn't. So I waited a year. Couldn't get arrested directing traffic. I used to play golf when I was in junior high school. I hadn't played golf in high school. Didn't play golf in college.
Play golf in L.A.
In Los Angeles. What else am I going to do? I'm a director, right? I can't do anything else. You know, when you're a director, you're jack of all trades, master of none.
Right.
So I went up on a Sunday afternoon, went and played golf with two buddies of mine. Some guy joined us. This guy was Patrick Hasberg. He had just created a new show called 20 on Jump Street. 11 years prior to that, he was a ski instructor in Aspen, Colorado.
A ski instructor?
Yes, for Michael Ovitz, for Mike Eisner, and Stephen Cannell. Three big wigs at the time. Stephen Cannell took him under his wing. Patrick had created Hardcastle and McCormick, which was a hot TV show at the time. And Patrick started to ask me questions. I was kind of bitter at the time. I'd been out here a year. I didn't think I'd ever work again or what would happen.
Did you tell him about the review? The great review.
I didn't.
I would have brought that up first. Well, I'll tell you what happened 1 year ago.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We had a great round. I played a great round of golf, shot like an 87. I really kicked everybody's ass. It was fantastic. We went to the bar afterwards, and he says, "I'm going to give you a call tomorrow." I said, "Oh, great. Yeah, sure. Right, whatever." The next day, my agent called me, and he said, "They want to hire you to direct an episode of 20 and Jump."
Come on. That easy? You play golf? You were personable?
Steve Beers, the producer, he called Steve Beers, the producer, and says, "Steve, I want you to hire David Nutter to direct an episode." And Steve goes, "Okay, well, I'll get his movie. We'll take a look at it." And Patrick said, "No. Hire him. I was in my fourth day of prep in Vancouver for my episode. And Bill Nuss, one of the producers, walked into my office and he goes, "You did go to film school, right?"
And you're like, "Yes." But you never directed TV?
No. But I was ready. So I was hungry enough. And I was
How do
ready.
You get ready? Has your technique changed since, you know, prepping for 21 Jump Street as it does for Game of Thrones?
You know, it doesn't. I often forget that I know what I know. So I treat it like it's my first job always. There's the fear. There's the sense of dread. There's a sense of I got to beat myself up to get through this. But I've learned that since in the last couple of years, I have to enjoy it more. But as far as the workload and so forth, as far as the work level is concerned, as far as the preparation is concerned.
This is a question for me. This is a selfish question. How do you get through? How are you good to yourself? How do you try to have fun? This is a question that should be so easy. You're doing what you love. It should love it. But you were so hard on yourself that it sounds like you weren't enjoying it for a long time because it was so much stress. But you just said you try to enjoy it more now. How do you do that? Or how did you manage to change the way you were thinking?
Well, I think what happened was is that I would enjoy it, but I wouldn't admit to it, I think. Some respects. And also, too, we both can kind of refer to something we both had a connection on is our backs. And I had, you know, a couple of years ago, I had terrible back surgery. I had knee surgery and so forth. Yeah. I had really beat myself up. And I realized when I finished that I didn't know if I'd ever direct again. My confidence was gone. I wasn't sure.
I remember when you were on Smallville and you directed this wonderful pilot.
Yeah.
Which people still talk about, which was changed my life.
Yes.
The show changed my life. You directing that pilot was an integral part of who and where I am now. And I remember the second episode when we got picked up for 22 episodes, you came on set and I noticed that you were having problems with your back.
Yeah.
And I could relate because I had surgeries. At that time, my back was okay, sort of. I just remember. People don't understand when you're in pain, if you have friends who are in pain or back pain or neck pain, whatever it is, if you don't have it, you cannot understand it. It is debilitating. It is, you know, it's your backbone. It's how you move every day. And so trying to work and doing something you're passionate about or trying to just be happy and live in the moment is hard when you have this pain.
Oh, very much so. And it's the kind of thing, too, you don't want to over-medicate and do all those things, which can be a real problem and mistake. But it's a thing which you realize that you have to take care of yourself. And I think that by finally taking care of myself, now I appreciate it a whole lot more.
Yeah, do you think, unhappiness or the stress or you, because you were in a lot of pain and you were just trying to get through days?
No. The pain was really pretty much isolated to that Smallville, the first episode of Smallville where I had a lower back issue and I had epidurals fixed that and didn't have surgery. And then I was pretty good for many, many years up until 2015 when my knee went out on me.
Did it go out while you were working?
It started to hurt me on the end of Game of Thrones.
Which episode?
Which was episode 509, 510, which was the final two episodes of season 5, where Jon Snow was killed and and Danny Saved by the Dragons, and the Walk of Shame occurs, and lots of things going to happen.
So you're directing the biggest episodes of the year for the biggest show on television, and you can barely get through it? Is that what you're telling me?
No, it wasn't so bad. But when I came home after finishing that in December, I have a commitment to go direct a pilot, so I went to Atlanta to direct a pilot called Containment, about a virus that takes over Atlanta for the CW, and then it started to hurt. And it didn't really kill me. I didn't go down until basically I was packing to leave, to go back home. I got to the airport, and I realized I couldn't walk to the gate.
How long did you end up having surgery?
Yes, I had surgery right away.
They said you can't wait any longer. You're going to lose feeling in your leg.
I had what was the doctor called, avascular necrosis, where you have bone on bone.
Oh my God, in your cartilage, this just sounds gone. Awful.
So I did that, and then my back kept hurting because I thought it was just walking incorrectly because of the knee, and realized it wasn't that at all. So I went back in, and in October I had the bone fusion in my lower back. But then a year goes by because that bone fusion didn't hold. The screws weren't big enough. So I had to get bigger screws the next year.
Inside of You is brought to you by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. This is an amazing platform. I use it on both podcasts. It has worked wonders for me. It's so amazing how easy it is to navigate. If you want to sell products, t-shirts, soap scents, whatever it is, Ryan, you want to sell, this is the way to do it. You could see what your best seller is right there, analytics, how much you're making this month, what products are selling the best. It's really fantastic. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million order stage, Shopify's there to help you grow.
Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered.
Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star.
Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way.
Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/inside, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/inside now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/inside.
What's up, everyone? It's Reality Steve, your number one source for all things Bachelor Nation and reality TV. Every day, I'm giving you the behind-the-scenes juice and your info on all your Bachelor Nation stories, and also interviewing some of your favorite reality stars. My name has been synonymous with spoilers, but I'm so much more than that. Give me a listen.
The Reality Steve Podcast, part of the Believe Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen.
How do you remain happy? Because I've had a lot of issues, and I'm just like, God, man, sometimes it's just hard to be, you're on set all day, you're talking to people, you're living your life. It's probably got to be a pain in the ass for your wife to be like, oh my God, he's in pain. He's like, I'm sure she feels for you, but it's probably hard on her.
Well, being on the other side of it now, it was very difficult. It was pretty much, it wasn't a good thing.
Yeah.
It was not a good thing at all. But I think that we have to experience the darkness to appreciate the light.
I think that's wonderful.
We really do.
That there is a light. Sometimes you think there's not.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to know that, hey, you're going through something tough now. And that's how I try to look at things. I mean, what else are you going to do? Say, oh, it's going to be like this forever? No, you're going to say, okay, well, tomorrow's going to be a better day.
Yeah, well, what happened was that I did season 5 of Game of Thrones, and then I took season 6 off, and I said I would come back for season 7. And that's when my bone fusion didn't hold. So what happened was is that I had to turn that down, and it broke my heart. And then December of 2016, I just had my second back surgery. I was feeling better. I wasn't 100% at all. And we had talked about, oh, come back for season 8, come back. And I said, yeah, but they have to see me. So at Christmas time, my wife and I went to Australia, where she's from, to see her family. And I said, well, if we're going to do that, I need to stop and see my family too. And they were in Spain shooting. So we stopped in Spain, and they hooked me up, and I got to the set, the Game of Thrones set. I met my Game of Thrones family, I guess is what I meant to say.
Yeah.
But
I knew what you meant.
I know. But what happened was I got there on a Sunday, and I said, what's going on? It was an old, you know, of course, a ancient city, and it had a little courtyard, a little piazza area, of course, and where all the cafes are and so forth. And I walked down there. People started coming out of the walls. People started coming out of the courtyard. People would see me.
David Nutter's here.
Yeah.
They love you.
It was really something special.
Isn't that something when you're and I felt like that because you only directed an episode and a half of Smallville, yeah, right? Maybe right. Two episodes. And I remember after the pilot saying, how many's David going to do? And they're like, oh, well, he goes on. He directs pilots. He gets shows started and he's there, but he goes off and does all these things to... He gives people a chance to grow. He does the pilot and then it's done.
Right.
And it did break my heart because we had such a connection on Smallville, and I just felt like the way you move the camera and the way you put everyone at ease with the way you directed, and to be directed by you is pretty fascinating because a lot of directors come in there and it's just they don't know how to talk to actors, or they just say, okay, you stand there, we're gonna do this, it's gonna be great. You had so much enthusiasm all the time. Just, hey, Michael, here's what we're going to do. You're going to be in the Luther Mansion. You're going to be fencing, okay? And we're going to hear the sound, and the Steadicam's going to come around, and it's going to pick up on this, and it's going to find you, and you're going to go to the bar, and you're going to take your helmet off or whatever in there, and then we're going to discover you, Lex Luthor, for the first time with this big smile or whatever. I don't know, whatever it was. And you just you explained the scene. You had enthusiasm. You knew what the character was more than I did. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing.
Oh, yeah, you did.
Well, I just said, you know, I learned my lines. I'm going to hit my mark. This guy, I'm in good hands. I got to be in good hands. I thought they were going to fire me. I didn't know.
Right.
I've never done a serious role on television or a movie like this. And you put my mind at ease. I felt like I got a chance with this guy. This guy is going to give get me to be the best I can be.
Well, you know, Michael, you're such an amazing talent. And to realize that you were willing to shave your head for this role, which is a pretty massive deal. Seriously, and willing to give that up for it, that I wanted to make sure that you had every opportunity to shine as I knew you would. Well, you know what happened with me on as far as the pilots are concerned? It was kind of interesting. My first pilot I directed was a thing called Space Above and Beyond for Morgan and Wong, who did the 20 Jump Streets and brought me on to the X-Files. And I did my first pilot. It was a big two-hour shot in Australia, and... I did that pilot, and then I was going to stay on as producer-director. And something didn't work out, contractually or something. I didn't do that. So the next year, I started reading it, the materials and so forth, started to read feature scripts, the whole thing, and I went back to the X-Files because that's where the best writing was. So I went back to the X-Files and did that, and then after doing that, I then hooked up with Chris Carter. I did the Millennium Pilot with Lance Henriksen, which was a pretty hot and pretty cool show at the
time.
How
was he to work with? Was he easy to work with or was he tough?
Chris?
Lance. Lance Henriksen.
You know, it was interesting. Lance was... He was such a pro, and his character was so specific. You know, Chris Carter is always very specific with his writing. And... He went out and did it. The most interesting part was the fact that when we finished shooting the pilot, because the Frank Black character was so in a sense into himself, so in a sense dour, so little emotion and so forth, he kind of so was sitting there by himself and kind of kept saying, "I don't know if I did anything," you know. And one of the examples of that was there was a big scene in which where he's basically explaining to all these cops and so forth about the Frenchman who's the serial killer, you know, what he's like and why is it his way he is. And he starts going into the verse of French literature and yeah, and all these various things and so forth. And he starts telling the story and so forth and moving his hands. And Chris comes over to me and he says, you know, people who talk like this are trying to sell something with their hands moving. People with their hands in the pocket are bored. So he should just basically say the words with his hands at his side. And Lance couldn't do that.
Wow.
Because it was very difficult to just tell an actor.
I don't know if I could do that because I talk with my hands exactly, like a human being.
Tell an actor, put your hands down to your side and just tell everybody.
That's
the story.
Just impossible. Lance did it.
20,000 feet later, he did it. But what's interesting was this, was the fact that Lance so inhabited this role. And it was also important that in order to do that, we did lots of research. I'll go back to Don Johnson and Ceasefire. I spent 6 months in vet centers going throughout the country, sitting in vet centers and talking to guys. I was 23 years old. I had no idea what that was all about. The movie played in all these theaters, and vets were coming out in tears. They did a Today Show episode about that film, how it affected veterans. And I kept saying, well, we walked blindly into the fire, but we had a firm step. And with that attitude, I've always said that it's all about the research and the preparation. So with Lance did the same thing, did a lot of research, did a lot of preparation. And at the end of the shooting the pilot, he got sat there and said, I don't know if I did anything. I said, well, you did so much. And he got nominated for a Golden Globe. I was so excited.
I mean, what is it about, like you'd say, like your strengths and weaknesses? Like, why so much success? Why does the biggest show on television ask you to come back? And why does the crew walk out when you land in Spain to see you? Why? I know it's your charisma. I know it's just, but obviously you're incredibly talented. What about your talent differentiates you from other directors that makes, because like obviously there's a lot of great directors, but what it is about you, what's your strength? What is it that you know you could bring that other directors aren't, that they want you for?
Yeah, it's a little, maybe a little self-serving, because I'm not the most talented. No one loves the people he works with more. No one gives a shit about them more. No one wants to inspire people more. No one wants to be able to get people and make them feel something more than that. Like, I can say that. It's been a thing where for my own self is, you know, and you may have been involved in this one, the Smallville pilot or whatever, but always at the end of a show, when I finish shooting a show, I get really emotional.
You do. I remember you crying.
Yeah, I get going, and because it's really quite something, because everyone gives their soul to a chance and gave me the opportunity to trust me. And that's something that I take very, very seriously. I take the trust. I take that very, very serious with people, and I also let them know that it matters to me, that they matter to me.
And that's what I felt. But there's even something beyond that. I think all that translates on screen, because you care so much about them and their characters and their work, that maybe that's what the talent is.
Well, I think so, too. I think it's a situation in which if you're not feeling it when you're shooting it, you can't expect the audience to catch it. You know, it's the type of thing in which when I did The Red Wedding for Game of Thrones, the big sequence at the end of the show, I shot it in a way that the last shot of the sequence was Catelyn dying. And just before that, Robb Stark dying. And so what happened was the fact that we shot out the build-up in order, set up in a way and ordered and so forth. And he was, of course, he was shot with arrows, and then his wife was stabbed in the stomach, and she went to the ground and she's bleeding to death. And he was shot with arrows, and he crawls over to his wife. And as he's kind of leaning, you know, hunched over his wife before he gets his final knife by Roose Bolton, he starts to look at her and see her blood flowing out of her, and she's dying. And I started to speak to him about love and relationships and all the kind of whatever. And he started to get very emotional. And I called cut, we finished and so forth. And I turned around, and all the makeup and hair girls were in tears. And I realized at that point, I'd realized that before, I think, too. But I realized that if you're not that far into it, how can the audience be that way? And what was so satisfying to me, what was so nice to feel, was when they did all the audience reaction videos, the people seeing the end of the
film. Have
wedding.
You seen those, Rob?
I have.
By the way, this is Rob, David.
Hey, Rob. How are you, buddy?
Rob started young. I'm 46, no kid. Look at him over there, 29 with a kid. It's amazing.
30.
30. Yeah, but so to me, it's always been a situation in which it's really, that's all I got is that.
I showed a girl I was dating that scene. She goes, I don't want to watch Game of Thrones. I'm not into all that old ancient shit. And I'm like, you have no idea. She goes, no, I'm not watching. I go, you know what? Then I swear to God, I dropped it right now. I go, how about you watch a scene with me? A 10-minute scene. Will you watch that? Out of context, you're just going to. And she sat down and I showed her The Red Wedding. I go, I don't care. You're going to watch this because I can prove to you what a great show this is. That's the scene that came up. And I watched that. I made her watch it. She goes, I had never seen the show. I didn't want to see the show. I'm not into TV. And she was in tears. She was in tears. Just in one scene without knowing anything that's going around, who these people are, hasn't been invested in these people. And that shows you how powerful. To me, that scene, I say this, and I'm not saying this because you're here, is not only the best scene probably in TV history, Okay, that's how I feel. I feel like Game of Thrones is the best show in the history of television. And I didn't want to watch it either to begin with. I was four seasons back, and my friends all said, Rosenbaum, you have to watch. And I was like, I don't watch a lot. And we all sat down here, and they watched me. They wanted to watch it with me, rewatch the show, so they could see my reaction, because they knew what their reaction was when they first watched it.
Sure.
So when I watched this, I try to tell people it's like watching a major motion picture, like when Gladiator came out with Russell Crowe.
Sure.
It's like seeing Gladiator every week.
So true.
That's what it's like. The impact that show has had on millions and millions of people. But for me, it's just like I'm watching the production value, the acting, the story. It's just the best thing. And so anyway, I don't know where I got with that.
No, but such amazing writing and so forth. And, you know, every character wants something. Every character has their own mission in their own life, has their own agenda, which is fantastic, because so much of the time you don't get that kind of depth and degree of difference in characters and uniqueness in the characters and so forth. And their actors are all so spot on. They're fantastic.
Who is your favorite? You can't say, because you're going to go back. You're going to go back and direct three more, right?
No, the season's, it's all over now.
You're done?
It's all done.
But you've done it.
Yeah.
So you've directed
three? I've directed three of the final six episodes of the series.
I know you can't tell me anything. Right? Because HBO, Game of Thrones, they'll kill you.
Oh, yeah. I'll be dead.
But can I try to get something from you?
You can try. We're okay. Going to try.
Is there a moment like the Red Wedding where I'll be like, oh, fuck? Will the audience be oh, fucked at least a couple times in that six episodes?
I promise you, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You looked at me. I wish you could
more
see
than,
your
more
face.
More than twice.
Like, who lives? If you had one person, Rob, who would you want to live? Mm. Me? I know. The Hound. Don't say anything. But the Hound, to me, that's my favorite character. I don't know what it is about him, but that he's a fucking badass. I love when he says, you're a cunt. You're a cunt. You're a cunt.
Tyrion.
You know what I'm talking about?
Well, I'll tell you, Tyrion, he's the greatest. But I'll tell you a story about Roy. Roy was an actor that
played the Hound.
The Hound, of course, he's just tremendous. Well, I came on the second season, and it had a little issues with his acting, his performance, and he hadn't done a lot of acting and so forth. He had a great look and hadn't done a whole lot of acting, and there was a sequence that he was supposed to do, and someone else actually did the lines for him and so forth, whatever. And then they said, "Well, David, you have a big scene with him, and we want to spend some time with him and so forth, and get him to hopefully whatever." And I watched all the stuff, and I sat down with him. I looked at him. We talked for a few minutes. And I said one thing. I said, quit acting. It'd be just like Clint Eastwood, just say the fucking words. And that's what he started to do. He would just say what he wanted to say. From that on, they thought I was like a magician or something.
Because you told them to just do nothing, be you.
Yeah. I was like,
I heard crazy shit. Like, he lives in the woods. He's like a mountain man.
Yeah, he is. He's definitely there's a great story I heard where he and Gerard Butler and there's this guy from Iceland who I worked with once, who I thought he's almost like a Arnold Schwarzenegger, real handsome, good looking, big muscle guy.
Right.
Where the three of them went out into the wilds of Iceland, and Roy and Yuri, who was the two guys, they went off to look for firewood to kind of make some fire. And as they did that, Gerard Butler left the battery on in the car, because he was waiting in the car for them, keep warm. And by the time they got back, the battery was dead. So basically they got back, and Roy went off into no man's land for like many miles to go get...
And Roy had left, just walked through the woods for... Yeah. Miles on end.
Yes, and he came back with a wheelbarrow and a battery for the car.
And that's who he was.
That was him, absolutely.
I want to meet that guy.
He's a fantastic guy.
He's a big guy.
Yeah, a very big guy.
Yeah, he's my favorite. Were you intimidated directing Game of Thrones when you first started? I mean, because your body of work is ridiculous. But, I mean, this is like, did you know what you were getting into? Like, what was your first episode?
It was season two. It was one episode three or four or five or six or something, one of the middle episodes.
Were you nervous?
I'm always nervous.
But this is even bigger than nervous. This is like...
Well, I have to tell you, Game of Thrones wasn't Game of Thrones yet, in a sense, season two. It hadn't grown up to that. But it was... I knew how good it was, just from everything I'd seen it and so forth. But And I'm always very nervous, you know, no matter the situation. But, you know, it's a situation you just got to jump in. And I also realize this is the fact that actors want to be directed.
They do, don't they?
They want to know from the director that the director's there watching what they're doing.
If you don't say anything, it's like, oh my God, what's going on?
Well, it's interesting. You know, years ago I did Band of Brothers. And these young actors, there are so many of them at the time. And they've all, many of them become stars. You know, Michael Fassbender, James McAvoy, all these guys. And what happened was, is the fact that they would see these guys shoot a scene and then you'd hear cut and all these young guys like standing around, okay, what's happening now, whatever, right? So what I started to do was I came in and I directed episode 4. And I started to do these big scenes with all the actors. And after I'd finished the scene, it was either a great action sequence or something cool would happen, or whatever. I turned to the guys and I'd say, butter, baby. It just came out. I don't know what that was. Just let them know that it was really fantastic. Wow. Just to let them know at the time that they did a great job. Because they weren't getting any of that.
And that helped probably substantially. They liked it.
For many years after that, they look at me and say, butter, baby.
Butter, baby. Isn't there some actors that just go, let me ask you, has there ever been an actor who just like, I don't need your direction. I don't need your approval. I know what I'm doing. Fuck off.
Yeah, but none of those. Anybody that's ever said that to me is not much of an actor.
Really? So it's never been one of the greats. It's never been a great actor who gives you shit. It's always the shitty ones.
You know, I've directed James Gandolfini, Edie Falco on The Sopranos, and you know, even George Clooney I've worked with, you know, on before ER I directed.
And always
I directed
gentlemen.
Brad Pitt before he did.
What'd you direct it with Brad Pitt?
What happened was is that, go back to the Patrick Hasberg, Stephen Cannell. Patrick Hasberg not only discovered me, but he discovered a couple other guys who have much bigger credits, Johnny Depp and Brad Pitt. And George Clooney, he started George Clooney in the show too. Brad Pitt had done a series for Patrick Hasberg in Vancouver called Glory Days about young kids, young guys in a high school newspaper. And they basically did like 7 episodes and it tanked, didn't do anything well. So Patrick, after having directed the 21 Jump Street for him, he said, I'd like you to come over and shoot like a wraparound of these 7 episodes and we'll sell them internationally. So Brad Pitt is going to put on some makeup, make him look like he's 40 years old. And this is right when Thelma and Louise was coming out.
Right.
And he was exploding. And we'll do a little wraparound for each of the episodes and you'll direct Brad Pitt. You know, at that point, he was just another young actor getting started. And he was great. He was great to
work
with.
Just nice. Just wanted you to talk to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So true.
Do you?
You know, they're all, because it's a situation in which you got to find your in sometimes with the actors and so forth. You know, I directed the Jonathan Pryce in Game of Thrones. Jonathan Pryce, Tony winner, Emmy winner.
Was that intimidating at all?
That was very intimidating. But you know what it is? I like to sit down with an actor and spend some time with them prior to. And what I did was I sat down with Jonathan Pryce and I tried to find that thing that I can say to him that no one else has said to him. And I spoke to him. I said, Jonathan, I just want to tell you one thing. You're the greatest listener I've ever seen act. Because if you ever watch Glengarry Glen Ross,
one of my favorite movies.
There's a sequence where Pacino, in the whole movie, he's listening and watching. There's a sequence.
He's going on to him about like this. He's like,
yeah,
well, in the beginning.
Yes, and Jonathan Pryce just sitting listening to him speak. And it's amazing what a tremendous actor he is.
Train compartment smell vaguely of shit.
Exactly.
Yeah, he does that whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. But I think the minute I said that to him, he trusted me. And I've also gone up to actors and, you know, big time guys like him, and they may have gotten a phrase wrong or something incorrectly, whatever. And you got to tell them. But also, I let them know that I'm there watching what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because a lot of directors are worried about the big picture. They don't think about what's the important part in the middle. You know, the two eyes.
Yeah.
So I always want actors to know that that really matters to me. And also, I spend a lot of time with them in the sense where I will, you know, talk to them about, you know, this is important to the scene and so forth, but I want you to know if we get to this moment, I'll come to you and let you know, are you happy with it? And if you are, then we'll move on. To give them.
So you're already happy at this point. You just want to know if they're happy.
Well, especially if it's something life-changing in the character, you know, a lot of Game of Thrones episodes in the past, there's been situations where characters, it's their last scene, or the last, either their last scene alive or the last scene the actor's going to shoot.
Have they ever know? Did they ever not know that? But you knew, like, they weren't. Did they always tell the actors on Game of Thrones, like, this next episode you're going to die? Or did it ever happen where they didn't tell them and they just came on set and they're like, wait a minute, what the fuck?
Well, I will tell you a kind of story similar to that, but not exactly that. I directed season 5 and there was the death of Jon Snow. And at the end of that, after we shot the sequence, they said, you know, we need to tell, you know, have kids say goodbye to the crew and everybody. So I went on set and so forth because I didn't want to know what happened next as an audience member. I didn't want to know what was going to happen in season 6. If someone tried to tell me, I said, I don't hear anything. After we finished season 5, I went to a fundraiser for Barack Obama at someone's house in Beverly Hills. And they were excited that I was there because he's a huge Game of Thrones fan. They were all big Game of Thrones fans. So I went and, you're there for a little cocktail thing, whatever, some lunch, whatever. And then you have your picture taken with the president.
Yeah.
So I walked up to the president and Jordan Kaplan, who's the head of DNC finance or something, said, this is David Nutter who directed the you know, Reigns cast in Red Wedding and all that stuff. And then he looked at me and he directed something and Brock put his hand, left hand on my right, on my shoulder and shook my hand. He says, you didn't kill Jon Snow, did you? Oh. And I said, yes, sir, he's deader than dead. Then he turned away and said, you kill all my favorite characters.
Brock said that?
Yes, yes. So what happened was, is that then a year goes by, and I actually told him about the story because I saw him again in another event at Comic-Con. I said this at Comic-Con, people kind of like freaked. But what happened was is the fact that a year later, he came back alive, of course, and it came out in the newspapers that David Nutter had lied to the president.
David Nutter is a liar.
I'm going to Guantanamo Bay.
That's amazing. I mean, to me, the intimidating thing is if, like, they just said, hey, direct the actors. Don't worry about all the CGI shit and the giant ships that are going on and the there's so many people working on this. Do you feel like you have a lot of help? Like, you could just really focus on a lot of the scene, or do you have to be part of all that shit?
Well, on Game of Thrones, the great thing about it is this, is the fact that I can direct, but directing is everything, isn't it? It's not just directing the actors. You're going to the production designer, you're talking to them, and you're going to location scouts, I'm blocking out the actors, I'm figuring out the blocking, the, you know, rudimentary camera moves and so forth, and all that, and working with doing the whole deal. So I think of that's my responsibility as a director anyway, to be involved in all that stuff. But the great thing is I don't have to check up on people. I don't have to go back and, you know, the prop guys.
They have their shit together.
They all have their shit together very, very much.
Have you ever been on set where you're like, we can't do this. Like, it's not working. It's just not working. We're going to have to reshoot this or something. Have you ever had to reshoot something?
A story comes to mind. In Palm Springs, directing Greg Evigan and Connie Selica. This is a guy from BJ and the Bear and Connie Selica from Hotel. For Glenn Larson, who was trying to make a resurgence in television. And we were shooting in Palm Springs, this crazy show. I forget the name of it, whatever.
Right.
They wanted to do this big, huge sequence. And I said, guys, we're never going to make the day if the sun's going to drop. So I said, we should shoot this direction before the sun goes down, and then come back and shoot that. And I said, no, we got to shoot the reverse. We have to shoot the reverse. I said, okay. You know, it's not going to work. So we shot everything that direction. And they said, well, shoot up against the sand dunes. And everyone was like, what's happening here? And I said, well, the producer wants us to shoot against the sand dune, so we'll do one take for each of the shots and just do it. And I knew they had to come back.
Jesus.
But, you know,
you warned them.
I warned them. But there have been other occasions, I think, where something may have not just been right or something, but they blocked out of my memory now.
I'm going to say a show of all these episodes. I want you to just give a word or one sentence of what comes to mind when you hear the show. Okay?
Okay.
For instance, if I said Roswell, 1999, you shot the pilot, what would you say about that experience?
I directed a movie just before that called Disturbing Behavior.
Uh-huh.
And they had wanted a director who directed X-Files and wanted to do it with, like, a set for teenagers. And it was the worst experience of my life. And I didn't know if I still could direct. So right after that, I get brought into Fox, and they said, we want to like you to direct this Roswell pilot with Jason Kadams. And I read this script and I said, this is magic. This is just what I want to do. And as I have to say, of all the pilots that I've done, that's the one that gave me my mojo back, I guess, because I realized I could direct. And it turned out really, really well. And it was a show that was for Fox Network at the time, but they had a new president. And he didn't like the show.
It only lasted a couple of years.
Actually, lasted 3 years. But what happened was that the fact that Fox was going to buy the show for the Fox Network, and then apparently they got a copy of the pilot at Warner Brothers. And Bob Daley, who was the president of Warner Brothers, saw the pilot and turned around and said, this is the best directed pilot I've seen in the year. We got to get it. So they started negotiating with the WB, Fox did, about getting the show.
I love that show.
Oh, I did too. I thought it was something quite special. And what happened was they started to negotiate the point. It got to the point where it was on, we got 22 episodes, which is never heard of anymore. 22 episodes behind Dawson's Creek. And it was, I was really, that was something really, was very.
Did you love the actors on that show? It was Sherry Appleby?
Oh, yeah. They were all fantastic. It was the best highest testing pilot in the history of 20th century Fox television.
Jesus. Dark Angel. Go back to Dark Angel, 2000.
Well, I had just done Roswell, and I told Jason Kams I want to stay on and be a producer director. It was the first time I wanted to do that. But I wasn't a good producer director because I wasn't someone that could actually oversee other directors. I didn't like to do that part. So I got a call from my agent saying, Jim Cameron wants to meet you on...
James Cameron.
Wants to meet you on Dark Angel.
Are you shitting your pants at this point?
Yeah, oh, yeah. This is right after Titanic, and he was like the biggest guy on the planet. So I went and had a meeting, and they liked what I had to say, and I read the script, and off I went to do Dark Angel. The great thing about Dark Angel is the fact that I had an audience of one. If James Cameron liked it, I'd be happy. That's all that mattered to me.
And he loved it.
It turned out well, yeah.
Did he call you and say, Dave, come direct Titanic 2?
No, he didn't go. He
didn't do that? How about Avatar 5? Nothing.
Still, maybe.
Then came a show, Smallville 2001. Was that a good experience for you?
That was a fantastic experience because what happened was is I sat down with Peter Roth, and he was the president of course, Warner Brothers Television. He wanted to, like, do the young Superman. He said, we're not going to do Superboy. We have to do the young Superman. And I said, what happened, my goal in that whole experience was the fact that Superman at that point was not the cool superhero. He wasn't Batman. He was the most iconoclastic superhero that was kind of removed from being real or of any kind of sense of believability as a person. I said, but Clark Kent, as a teenager, there's a lot of things that he can't have. He doesn't know where he's from. He doesn't know where he's going. He looks in the mirror sometimes and sees a monster and sometimes sees an angel. And sometimes there's parts of his life that he really has lots of issues with growing up. Every teenager can relate to that. If I can make the world real, then we have something special. And by the casting of yourself and Tom and everybody, it was amazingly turned out great. I was very, very happy with that.
Other great shows, you know, and we talked about briefly, but we were both shocked by the whole Allison thing. You know, we talked about that.
Oh, yes, sure.
And that was like, you know, people always say, how was it working with Allison? She was wonderful, right?
She was fantastic. She was such a pleasure, such a treat. Everyone was a pleasure to work with. It was a great working experience.
Yeah, that's how I felt. Supernatural. Let's. I'm passing a couple, but I'm just going to go to Supernatural because that has lasted, what is it, 14 seasons?
14 seasons.
And people don't understand this. Rob, I don't know if you know this, but when you direct a pilot, you get paid for every episode that airs in the series.
I did not know that.
Is that correct?
Everyone they make, yeah.
Everyone they make. Now, is that negotiable, the price?
Well, it can be, yeah, absolutely.
So it doesn't have to be like $5,000 per episode. It could be more.
No, Supernatural. Well, the thing about Supernatural was this, is the fact that Supernatural, like a lot of other shows that I've worked on that actually grabs me, was the fact that this was a show about two brothers that lost their mother in the opening sequence and are looking for their dad. My dad died in a car accident when I was a year and a half old. So these stories about families that aren't quite together and trying to form and so forth has always been something that has affected me and something that I get drawn to. I want to do a pilot where the story has to be told. The characters have to do what they're doing. It's not a choice. So that's something that really matters. And to me, this was something that was a great story. It wasn't about the scary stuff at all. It was about two brothers looking for their dad after losing their mother. That was something that I thought was very special.
Wow. And those guys are great. Jared and Jensen are
Jared tremendous. And Jensen are fantastic. It was funny.
He was on Smallville. He did many episodes of Smallville.
Jensen tested for Clark Kent.
Yep,
that's right. And it's also a situation when we did the casting for Jared and Jensen. It was a situation in which Jensen was originally going to play the other character, the Sam role. And so Eric Kripke and I called Jensen. They said, "Hey, guy, how would you like to do the?" We kept kind of referring to Skywalker, Luke Skywalker, and Han Solo.
Right.
And I said, "How would you like to play Han Solo?" He said, "Sounds good to me." And of course, it turned out beautifully.
Wow. Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Well, it was interesting. Jim Cameron was not involved in that, but I remember sitting down with the writer and the producer, and we sat down at a table for four, and I said, "This empty chair, that's James Cameron's chair. So this is, it has to be worthy of his name on it." And that was something very important. And it was also the real special thing was with that was it was a tremendous script, but finding Lita Headey was really the...
For me, they said 700 other guys aren't doing this right. I'm like, what the fuck are they doing wrong? How could there's a lot of better actors than me. What's the difference? And you never know what the difference is. I don't know sure. if it's something that they whatever is in the creators' minds or the director's mind. It's like when you walk into a room, I always say, before you say anything, they know if you're the type right away.
Oh yeah, and also too, what's interesting is the fact that executives don't always get it right. You know, I did a pilot once. And I can't say what it was, but I had an actor come in and read for the role. And after he read for the role, the president of the studio, not the network or the studio, but the president of the company, he was like the huge kahuna, second command of this huge company.
Right.
Turned to me in a small room with too many people in it and said, "Dave, what did you see in this actor?" And I said, "Well, he was this, and that," and all these sort of serious things I thought was very special about him. He said, "I didn't see any of that. That was Heath Ledger."
Wow.
So,
yeah.
That's what happened.
And that guy who made that decision probably had a degree in marketing.
Probably so, probably yes, so. Yes.
We can go quickly here. Arrow and Flash.
Arrow and Flash were me coming back to my roots of Smallville. Again, both those shows were shows that basically started in the real world. And what happened to these characters changed them. So I love telling origin stories like that. I couldn't direct like the Supergirl pilot because that feels like already a little too already there.
Yeah.
So to me, if I can render a sense of real world to it or any sense of some reliability as far as the real world's concerned, I always jump at that chance and turn in something special. Well, those are two great experiences.
I just had Stephen Amell on.
He was the first actor that walked in and read for the role, and I saw his picture and I said, "That's the guy."
He said, "David Nutter gave me a thumbs up and said, 'See you in Vancouver,' before I had been approved by the WB, the CW, and Les Moonves." But you did that.
Well, that's what happens. You know, you it's like my wife, when I was met my wife for the first time, she opened the door and I fell in love and walked in the editing room or garage of the house this guy was carrying the movie in, and I laid down these film canisters and said it aloud to myself, "I'm going to marry that girl. She can be the mother of my kids." It's love at first sight.
You have two kids.
Yeah, I have two kids. And it's really love at first sight. It's one of those things where it's like that kind of charisma is quite special.
What else can you do? What else do you want to do? Will you ever retire? You're 58, you said?
Yep.
Do you ever see yourself being retiring at a young age? Or there's too much left in the mind?
No, I think I need to work because it keeps me young. It keeps me going, keeps me excited. I need that passion, the passion of work. I need that feeling. It's something that really means the world to me.
It's like a second lover in a way. You got your wife who you love and your work.
Very much so. It was a situation which me coming back to Game of Thrones this year, you know, I was still kind of getting myself back on my feet and coming to do the three episodes. I was going like, "Oh man, can I do it? But the minute I got the script, the minute I landed in Belfast, the minute I got the apartment, the minute I walked on set, I felt like $1 million.
What did you do after you read the first episode in the final season of Game of Thrones? When you read, did you read all six?
I actually not only read all, I didn't. Here's what happened: is they had a read through of all six of all the actors, read all the scenes
in a private room with a lot of security.
Oh yes, yes, very much so.
Like people had to be like, make sure there's no audio cassette, there's no nothing. How strict is it to come in here, to come into a room to do a reading? Like, did you have to go through a security thing?
It wasn't quite that bad, but it was pretty tight. That's for sure. What's interesting is the fact that I was directing episodes 1, 2, and 4. So I read 1, 2, 3, 4. I didn't read 5 and 6.
Because as a fan, you didn't want to.
I wanted to hear them when they were read. So I actually got a chance to watch it that way.
Did you?
And I'll tell you one secret.
What?
Kit Harington.
Yeah.
He was reading it. He hadn't read it before. So in the read-through, it was his first time to read some of the sequences that happened.
Did any of the actors cry during the readings?
Maybe they may have been in tears as other actors performed stuff. Yeah.
That's ambiguous, yet really interesting. You fuck. No, but think about it. So you're saying that some people responded to other actors reading certain things.
For the first time.
For the first time.
Yeah.
Did you cry at all in the reading? Did you get emotional on set?
I got emotional at the end of like the Christmas break. I said goodbye to the crew and a couple other times, yeah.
What was it, the best experience you've had in your life?
Yes.
They're doing like 6 spinoffs though, right? You can do all of those?
They're doing one.
One?
One spinoff.
Are you going to work on it maybe?
Well, we'll see what happens. Keep our fingers crossed.
You can't really say too much, can you?
Well, I know that I think it's out. Jane Goldman, who wrote Kick-Ass and The Kingsman.
Oh, yeah,
she wrote The Kingsman and Kick-Ass. She's written it, and they're getting, you know, they're moving along forward to make it happen, I think.
How many offers do you get a year?
I wish my agent would tell me the truth. I'm not quite sure about that one, but I do have a commitment to Warner Brothers for every year to direct a pilot for them. I've had it since Smallville.
That's 2001, so you've had it for 17 years so far. How long does it last?
Well, it's kind of re-upped and changed every couple of years or whatever.
So it's a deal. It's like, it's a deal, yeah. and you know how much you're getting paid for this pilot.
Yeah, yes.
This has been a real treat. Rob, this is so educational, and you're an amazing human being, but you're just like such a passionate guy. And I think, you know, I always like, why is David such a great director? But, and we talked about it, but I think it's your real love, your wife and your work, your family and your work. And
well, you know what it is the fact that, there's two things that work in a relationship, vulnerability and trust. And I think that if you show your vulnerability and people can trust you, I think that they'll follow you. And they also want a Pied Piper. They want someone who knows what they're doing. They want someone who has an idea. A crew will work, and actors will work 10 times harder if they know that there's a plan. They don't mind doing something where they get time to shoot an extra take or an extra scene, an extra shot or something to make them look better or to get into the shot more, as long as they know that there's a plan involved. So that, to me, is something that I'm a big believer in, is rehearsal and making sure the actors know that there's a plan.
Do you have a say in pilots that you direct always? Is that part of your deal? Like, I want to help cast this person?
In casting, yes. I like to be involved in the casting very much, so that's a big part of it.
So the next time you're casting something, is there a possibility if something is right for me, you'll think of me again?
Absolutely.
And think, you know, this guy gave me a good performance. You see how I'm working an angle here?
He's working.
You do this in almost every interview now.
Well, why not? He's my friend. He knows my ability. He directed me. He knows what I'm capable of.
And he's so much better now after all these years of experience.
Oh, my God. A little older, but...
Still handsome.
You know, relatively. Relatively, yeah. You too. You look good. I couldn't believe you're 58. I thought you were like a little older than me, maybe 2 years.
Yeah.
Thank you for allowing me to be inside of you, David Nutter.
Well, it was a lot of fun, you being there and playing around. And fortunately, there was a lot of room for you. That was good.
Did you enjoy it?
I had a great time, Michael.
I mean, this
fun.
Is great. I really
Rob
learned
was a great,
so much.
Great audience, too.
Yeah, Rob, thanks for being here. Welcome to Talkville,
the ultimate Smallville rewatch podcast. Guest star Sarah Carter as Alicia Baker. Although I didn't really work with her a lot. But Tom did, and they had some real big smoochy scenes.
Yeah. Should we talk about that?
Could there be any more sex? What was a 3-page makeout scene that just kept going? Good Lord. We get it. They have chemistry.
Jump in now or catch up on any of the past seasons of Talkville on YouTube or wherever you listen.